It's not often that I get to speak to a legend, and I use that word advisably, but ladies and gentlemen, it is my great pleasure to be speaking to a legend very soon. The book is out called Stirling Moss, My Racing Life. It's a very personal book with Stirling Moss guiding the reader through his motor racing life with a fascinating, insightful, and often amusing commentary to an unrivaled collection, over 300 photographs, many of which will be unfamiliar to even his most ardent fans. He takes us from his childhood to the height of his fame as Mr. Motor Racing and then to the sudden end of his racing career with that crash at Goodwood in 1962. It is my immense pleasure to welcome onto the show Sir Stirling Moss. Sir Stirling, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So it's a fascinating book. It's a beautiful book full of hundreds of gorgeous photographs. I mean, when you look back at it, you were racing in a golden age for motor racing.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was racing 50 races a year. Now all they do is about 16 or 18, because I would fly to Australasia and South Africa or South America during the off season, so I covered the whole lot.
There's a wonderful couple of pictures as well. You're saying you loved racing at NASA at the end of the year, and the picture of you racing in Cuba.
That's right. Yes. Oh, yes. I think I raced in Cuba twice, actually.
So, I mean, what was the idea? I mean, this book commemorates 60 years since perhaps your greatest triumph in one of the greatest motor races of all time, of course, the 55 Mir Miglia. Time has flown by.
Oh, very much. I must say, of course, races like the Mille Miglia aren't held now, and obviously couldn't be. I mean, it just wouldn't happen. Because it was extremely dangerous, and they had something like 700 entries. Now, if you think of 700 Italians would go faster, take down the centre, going flat out round Italy, you can see it was obviously a pretty hazardous place to be.
And, of course, this was one of the first, because this race you had a co-pilot, Dennis, the great Dennis Jenkinson, and he introduced for the first time, if you like, cockpit technology with a roll of paper.
Oh, absolutely. I think we call it our toilet roll, and it was, I think, about 27 metres long, I think, and on there, because there's no way we were going to remember all the corners. It's just impossible. And so we made this out and wrote sketches to show what corner was like, whether it went to the right or the left or over a brow or something like that. And then Jenks interpreted what we'd written before and gave me hand signals, like if you take your hand and wave it up and down very fast, that would be slower. If it was just a gentle movement, that would be a hell of a lot quicker, and so on. So and it worked amazingly well.
The other thing I didn't realise, I'd never seen this story until I read the book, about the great Fangio giving you some South American tablets to get through the race, which seemed to keep you awake for a bit.
I have no idea what they were. If they had, I would certainly recommend them, because the race, you remember, I started at 7:22 in the morning, which meant we were up by 5:30, I suppose, and went right through the 10 hours for the race, and then continued on after the frivolities and everything else, continued on up to Stuttgart, without a stop. So I was on dope.
You drove 400 miles after the race up to have a meeting with the management of Mercedes-Benz.
Well, I thought they should be quite. They were obviously very excited about the fact that I won this incredible event that only Italians ever win. And so I thought, well, the best thing I could do really is drive up there and show them the car. I didn't drive in the racing car, but go up there and sort of meet them and go on local radio and all that sort of stuff.
Of course, you were sort of an Englishman racing for a German team. Mercedes were a huge organisation in the early 50s and mid 50s. It must have been quite a daunting prospect when you sat in front of the fabled team manager.
I mean, Neubauer, you're referring to.
Absolutely.
Great, fantastic man. Great sense of humour. He really was quite saucy, the things he said, and so on. But he would sort of thing like, well, I have a 40-year-old secretary, I'm going to sack her and get two at 20 years old, that sort of stuff. But apart from all those things, he had a wonderful man, kept everybody away from us, made sure we had, quiet rooms for sleeping, off hours and so on. He was just like a father figure.
And of course, I mean, you took the famous 55, the win at Aintree, the first sort of British driver to win the British Grand Prix. You were known for favouring British cars. Your time with Vanwall, of course, is legendary.
Yeah, well, I wanted, that was my whole thing right from the start of my racing, because the war was not long over when we started doing hill climbs and races. And so I wanted to, if possible, you know, drive a British car. And quite honestly, there were none at all. And so I called together about 10 guys in the press and said, look, what should I do? I've been offered a drive with, at that time, I think it was Maserati. And I've been offered a drive Maserati, but I want to drive British. And they said that we'd far rather that you won on a foreign car. I mean, a British person winning in a foreign car is certainly better than no British entry at all. And so I thought, well, that's nice to know.
So when did it all sort of start off? Because you started racing, was it 18 or 19 that you started racing?
Yeah, I started 18 on hill climbs because racing didn't exist at that time. You know, because the war was over, and it certainly didn't exist over here, but then they started with hills and then the odd aerodrome. But to do really good tracks, you know, Belgium and Holland and Italy and all around the place, was really great.
I mean, it must have been, it was an extremely dangerous time, but it must have been an awful lot of fun as well, because there seems to be an awful lot of camaraderie between, you know, yourself, Tony Brooks, Peter Collins, Mike Hawth, you know, Mike Hawthorne. I mean, there was a real sort of clubby atmosphere to young men going around Europe and further afield and racing basically most weekends.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was every weekend, at least one race, but we were, you know, really, we were really good friends, and of course, but once the flag fell for the start of a race, then we were, you know, enemies, and we'd just go like hell to try and beat the other.
And of course, it wasn't just Formula One that you were racing, or Formula Racing. I mean, you were doing long distance sports cars. You know, you famously, yeah, with a hair in the 1959 at Le Mans, you were the hair that broke the Ferraris, of course, with your Aston Martin.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I would drive anything, quite frankly. I mean, just tell you one funny story. At Monaco, I was in Formula 3, we're talking now 1946 or 7, and I was very young, and we did they had a race for Formula 3 cars at that time. Formula 3 was 500cc, and I had a Cooper Norton. And they went out in practice, which was 7 in the morning, because obviously we weren't as important as the main cars. And we went round and practiced for half an hour or so, and then came in, and Pete Collins and myself said, let's go and have a cup of coffee in the Hotel de Paris, which we did. And there was a dear old English lady in there. She said, were you one of those young men making all that noise? So we said, yes, I'm afraid we were. What were you doing, she said. I said, we were practicing. She said, can't you go and practice somewhere else? She obviously wasn't an enthusiast.
Absolutely not. But again, we're saying, you know, you're racing all over the world. Also, the forward to this book is by another British world champion. Of course, it's Lewis Hamilton. What's your opinion of a young Lewis, and how different is he? Of course, the modern Formula One driver from your day, as it were.
Well, I mean, really, if you're going to be a champion this year, you also will have the same sort of thing 10 years ago and 10 years ahead. I mean, there's always the top, the middle, and the bottom, you know. And I must say, I mean, Lewis, for instance, who is tremendously fast. I mean, he's one of the late breakers, very exciting to watch. Very, very good. He's got a Mercedes engine, which is almost mandatory if you want to win. But I think he's doing a tremendous job for us, quite frankly.
I mean, would you, looking back at it, would you like to be a modern racing driver? Do you think, you know, again, you were racing the most...
No, they don't have anything like the fun we used to. We had a lot more fun. I mean, you know, socialising and chasing the crumpet and all that sort of stuff. I mean, now they're very much more... They have to go. I mean, if Lewis wins a race, he has to go over and chat up a Vodafone and things like that. Well, in my time, you know, Vodafone didn't exist, and so we were free to go and chase the crumpet.
So I suppose we were quite lucky at that point, or you were quite lucky that, you know, we didn't have social media and whatever following your every move then, Sir Sterling.
Oh, we certainly did. You know, I can tell you, if I took a girlfriend out, you know, I'd get more publicity than somebody I didn't know that well, or even winning a race.
So, who? I mean, you've raced with some of the greats. Was Fangio perhaps the greatest teammate, the greatest?
In my opinion, Fangio was the greatest Formula One driver. For whatever reason, I could beat him in sports cars. I don't know why, but I could. But in Formula One, which of course is the pinnacle of racing, he certainly was the best, and I think, frankly, he's unsurpassed now. I think that Senna was somebody of his class, as was Jimmy Clark.
Yeah, absolute greats. One of my colleagues has just rushed in with a piece of paper. Was it your grandfather, Richard? Just one second. Was it your grandfather, Richard?
Grandfather, yeah.
Grandfather was Cyril Keefe, I believe, who used cars and raced.
No, Cyril Keefe was a guy who made a car.
That's right.
I knew him. He's from Wales, actually. Not related to anything.
So you're still keeping yourself, obviously, in the racing thing. I mean, after the horrendous crash at Goodwood, you tried to come back to racing. Some say you came back, tried to come back a little too early.
I was certainly a year too early at that, yes.
And
you see, it's easy to say that now, but if you were there at the time, the press were always calling up Stirling, you're going to be at the Spa Grand Prix this weekend, you're going to go to Monza with this. You know, they kept on and on, and I thought, well, I must give them a decision. I went to Goodwood, and although my time was quite good, it wasn't quite as fast as before, but I just didn't know that I could make it, and so I thought, well, really, rather than carry on in a sport as it has been, which is awful, I'll announce my retirement, and I think in hindsight, I should have waited another year, and I think things would have been a lot better, but otherwise, I found myself at the age of 32, with no business. So you had to work for a living, and nearly killed me.
But because after the Goodwood crash, I mean, you were unconscious. You were in a coma
I was unconscious for a month and paralysed for 6 months on one side. Yeah, so it was quite serious.
Yeah, absolutely. But I've read the book, The Racing Driver, by Dennis Jenkinson of that time. You reinvented yourself. You came back as a pundit, but you also built yourself this marvellous muse house in London.
Oh, well, that's where I am now. I'm speaking to you from there now. It's absolutely fantastic.
Everything is at the push of a button. And I had a phone call in from a listener saying, ask Stirling if he still has the heated toilet seat.
Yes, of course I do. Obviously, I mean, doesn't everybody? At school, we used to have fags, and you'd send your fag to warm the loo seat. That's how it all started, I think. But no, certainly I do, yes.
And of course, even though you're in the middle of London, you don't drive a large, flashy car. You had a scooter for a while, and you've now got a zingy or a twingy or something?
A Twizy. A Twizy's electric car from Renault. And in London, it's absolutely terrific. I mean, the first important thing is, in my area, it costs you £5 an hour to park. If you've got a Twizy, you don't pay. You find a meter, put it on the meter, there's no charge. Apart from that, it's quiet, it's easy to park, and it's really got a tremendous amount of things going for it, particularly if you happen to live in London. I mean, I wouldn't expect to go on a journey much further than the North Circular, but that's plenty.
And of course, you are as busy now as you ever were when you were racing.
Oh, certainly, just as much. I mean, flying all over the place, which is wonderful. I mean, I've just got back from doing the Mealy Mealy, or not doing it, but being connected with it and so on. And, of course, there's Goodwood coming up, and there's events really very frequently.
And the Goodwood Revival is obviously a fantastic event, and it's one that you celebrated your birthday at a couple of years ago as well, with a Marilyn Monroe lookalike and a certain chauffeur called Damon Hill.
That's correct. Absolutely correct.
what are your next plans then? Is it British Grand Prix for you and then the busy the rest of the summer?
Yeah, the British Grand Prix, of course, is coming up, and I've got other events that I shall be going to, and just generally sort of keeping as close as I can to the people in the sport and enjoying it.
The book is called Stirling Moss, My Racing Life. It came out earlier on this month. Is in conjunction with the wonderful Simon Taylor. So, Stirling Moss, it's been a pleasure to speak to you today.
Thanks a lot.
Take care. Stirling Moss, ladies and gentlemen, an absolute legend and a pleasure to speak to.